Yuba College, Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. Monday afternoon, October 30, 1972. Bible 302, Wisdom Literature of the Old Testament, continuing the study of the book of Ecclesiastes, and picking it up today at chapter 5, verse 6, syllabus question 414. Really, 415, we were dealing with the spiritual evasions of people who make vows and then explain them away, this kind of thing. And in chapter 5, verse 7, 415 now, Kohelet has a comparison between dreams and wordiness, too many words. A comparison here between them, these two kinds of things. And the point of this comparison is that too many dreams mean you've got too many things on your mind. And too many words mean you're a fool with a big mouth. And it's a comparison set up like a mathematical proportion. As A is to B, so C is to D. As too much on your mind is to the experience of dreams, so being a fool with a big mouth is to having too many words spoken, which perhaps don't mean much of anything. Now, me and my big mouth, you know, I think I compared this a little bit to that noted evangelist, Bob Hope. Well, there's hope for Bob Hope. He could be converted. This is possible, not beyond the power of God. We're sinners and Bob Hope has been converted. I think he needs to be, though. This is my candid opinion that Bob Hope means the same thing Nicodemus means. Well, Kohelet sums up 1:16 all formalistic worship by calling it a fool sacrifice. And we could quote another place in the Bible where it says, God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. God is not mocked. You can fool other people, but you can't fool God. And of course, really, you can't fool your own conscience either. Now, next, chapter 5, 8, and 9, comfort in the face of oppression. And the specific kinds of evils are mentioned here, injustice and oppression of the poor. And this is chapter 5, verse 8. Just a moment till I find it, and I will read it. If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violence perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. Now this raises in the first place the question, what's the difference between justice and judgment? He mentions these two things, one after the other, justice and judgment. Do they mean the same or do they mean something different? Well, Mrs. Hartman, do they?
Right. Very different.
Sorry,
justice. Talking about making
these are obviously closely related concepts, as the words would indicate, but justice means decisions in cases and lawsuits. You go to the courthouse to get justice, which you hope to. Just decisions in trials and prosecutions and lawsuits. And that's judgment. Judgment means just decision. And justice is the personal quality of fair-mindedness. Now, a judge who has a quality of justice will also issue judgments that are right. One refers to acts, the other to a personality trait or a personal quality. Now, going beyond this, 420, why was corruption of justice common in Palestine in Kohelet's time? Now, taking this on the basis that it is from the Persian period, why would it be common or not surprising during this time? All right, where was the capital of the Persian Empire? Many of you know. That's pretty. Does I know where it was? Well, the real capital was Persepolis, later burned Alexander the Great. Susa or Shushan was the branch white house on the California coast. But these two together are the two poles of an axis here. Very far, many hundreds of miles to the east. And Palestine is far west almost as the Persian Empire went, on the coast of the Mediterranean. Therefore, it is very far from the center of government power and authority, far removed from the center of authority. Therefore, local and provincial officials could do some pretty awful things with comparatively little likelihood of getting caught. You see, they're so far away from where authority was centered, it would take so long that somebody to file a complaint and get it investigated and get an answer back. So the result of this would be that these local officials quite often simply did things their own way, and this, of course, was often unjust to people. We can see this in our own time. You may get a bum deal from a local justice of the peace. If you can manage to carry your case up to the federal courts, and especially the Supreme Court, there's a much greater likelihood that it will be decided according to the law and the evidence than if you try to do it in Podunk at the crossroads. You may have to start there. But the higher up you get in the judicial system, in a country that has a judicial system that purports to be honest, the more likely you are to get really equitable treatment from the court. Now, Palestine is out on the fringe, so this was not surprising. Why was corruption of justice not to be wondered at? Lupo says, in reality, it was a common evil that honeycombed the entire fabric of government throughout all the various grades of officialdom. Now the Watergate case. The Democrats, of course, are making a big thing of this, and the Republicans are trying to hush it up as far as they can. The thing that surprises me, though, is how many Americans don't seem to think it matters. They seem to think, well, that's politics, what do you expect? Actually, this is probably as bad a scandal as we've ever had in American history. And it cries to heaven for honesty in government. Now, I won't prejudge it. I'll leave the Senate and so forth to investigate after the election's over. But in the meantime, from CBS had quite a long piece on it the other night. It is highly scandalous and very, let's say, damaging to the good name of the present administration. And I'm not favoring one candidate above the other either. But this is an example of apparent, let's say, alleged corruption of justice, a common evil. People get callous to this kind of thing after a while. It doesn't stir them up with indignation. They get to sort of, well, what do you expect? Government officials are going to be like that. Now, I lived in Japanese-occupied China, and let me tell you, that country was extortion-ridden. Racket-ridden and extortion-ridden from the emperor down to the lowest local policeman. The school I taught in, something like Moody Bible Institute, we had 100 students, and it was a three-year course to train them for evangelistic work. It was closed by government order. We had to close on a trumped-up charge. Two counts against us. One was that we had held classes on some government-designated holiday. Well, they had so many of these that they hardly understand the whole class if you stop for every one. That was one charge. The other was that under a totalitarian government such as theirs, this type of institution was regarded as unnecessary. Now, you can see the kind of thinking that involved in that, an unnecessary type of institution. So we had to close, and they gave us a little time to get the students off the campus and away from there, but we had to close, and it was almost a year before we succeeded in getting that open again with a small fraction of our former faculty and student body, about 2 dozen instead of over 100. And I asked my Chinese secretary, do you think that $50 in the palm of the right official would get this school open again. He said, oh, I wouldn't take near that much. This is what they were fishing for, a bribe. Now, Manchuria under the Japanese, I said, it was racket-ridden, and the restrictive laws and regulations would fill a big book. There was no end to them. It was a rule against us about anything you could think of. We couldn't have a meeting in church outside of our regular services with more than 10 people present, and people without permits from police. Everything was regulated by arbitrary and oppressive rules. But we learned that there was no one of all these rules that you couldn't get a dispensation from by bribing the proper officials. There wasn't a one of them, from the emperor down to the local police station. You could do anything. You could get away with violating any one of these numerous laws and rules if you would put the proper amount of money in the pocket of the proper official in a properly quiet way. Now, we wouldn't do that. We're not going to compromise with that kind of a system. And you know, like throwing meat to a man-eating tiger, he gets an appetite for it, likely to want some more. We did not compromise with that. We worked on it for about a year and finally took a, reverently, a chance and opened the school without government permission and continued one semester with a fraction of our student body. And started in the second semester of that year, this was 1940-41, and they closed us down again, and this time we had only 24 hours to get the students away. It was a sad day. There was some tears shed by the students on that day. But everything in that country was racket-ridden, and anything, whatever, you could do and get away with it if you bribed somebody. Now, I don't think as bad as that in Tokyo ever was. But this was way out on the fringe in the continental Asia, far from the center of authority, and a lot of people of low character had gone there and held government jobs and so forth, and that was what we were up against. Now, 422, according to chapter 5, verse 9, there's something about a king here. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. Well, first of all, in verse 8, marvel not at the matter. That is, don't be surprised, for this kind of corruption is what's going to happen among sinful people. There, he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. That is, local officials have higher ones over them, and they have higher ones over them. This can go clear on up sometimes. Now, the next verse. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. That is certainly not clear in the King James Version. It seems to be a statement, as you read it there, that kings have to eat like other people. And what do they eat? They eat carrots and potatoes and cabbages and bread made out of wheat that grows in fields. So this seems to be a dietary and agricultural note on the care and feeding of kings. At this point. Now, it can hardly be the real meaning, because that would be quite out of context with what comes before it and after it here. So we're left with a rather baffling statement here in verse 9. The profit of the earth is for all, the king himself is served by the field. Obviously, the profit of the earth is for all. Who is there that doesn't eat? And what do people eat except what grows in fields? Either made of vegetables, it's produced by farming. This, however, would be a statement of the obvious, and there is no way to show how it fits the connection here. Now, this is translated somewhat differently in the Revised Standard Version, which I brought with me today on purpose because of this verse, chapter 5, verse 9. But in all, a king is an advantage to a land with cultivated fields. But in all, a king is an advantage to a land with cultivated fields. Now, any land where people live has cultivated fields. Antarctica doesn't have them, but nobody lives there either. A land with people has cultivated fields, and this would be a way of saying that even a bad government is better than no government at all. That even a bad and corrupt government is better than absolute anarchy. And you could make a case for that, maybe. I doubt, though, that that is the true meaning. Now, the RSV also has a footnote with an alternative translation of this. The prophet of the land is among all of them. A cultivated field has a king. This is still taking the king there as being a human king. And the connection then would be somewhat obscure. Now, Leupold translates this differently, and he holds that the king there means God, the true king of kings. Leupold's translation of this verse, it is an advantage to a country on the whole that there is a king over the cultivated field. And he holds that this means God, and that therefore, let's say, in the end, the rackets and the corruption are going to come under the righteous and moral judgment of God in the end. And also he can curb them, and does, of course, to some extent during the meantime. Anybody have any comments on that difficult verse, Jim?
I have a paragraph part in James that Luther does in the original.
No, those are put in by the printers and translators of the Bible. Where's the paragraph mark? Verse 9. Yeah, just a minute. Yeah, this doesn't have it in this one of mine. No, the prophet of the essence for all. No, this is King James, but it doesn't have it. Part of the, those are added by editors and printers of the text, like the chapter and verse numbers. Now, chapter 5, verse 10 to 6, 12, and this will bring us, when we finish it, to the end of the first half of the book, to the end of the negative part of the book. This will be the end of clearing the deck here and demonstrating that all is vanity, so that you can go on in chapter 7 through 12 with the positive part and figure out how to enjoy life and really do something worthwhile in spite of the bad conditions. Now, first thing here is the vanity of riches. They are unable really to satisfy a man. The vanity of riches. And we have here 5:13, a sore evil which I've seen under the sun, namely riches kept for the owners of thereof to their hurt. Those riches perish by evil travail. He begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. If he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. This is a sore evil. That in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? All his days also he eateth in darkness, and hath much sorrow and wrath with his sickness. Now, the inability of riches to satisfy someone. And he also speaks here a little further about insomnia and from too much eating and drinking. Oh, above here. Yeah. Chapter 5, verse 10. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver. He that loveth abundance with increase, this also is vanity. When goods increase, they are increased at 8 cents. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? So a cartoon of a man standing outside the door of a supermarket, and his wife and 5 kids lined up there going into the shopping, and he's holding his paycheck in his hand. If you go on in and start loading up the cart, then I want to gloat over this a little bit longer. And that paycheck, you know, it looks like money, but it's going to vanish away. What good is it if you get an increase in your salary or your wages if the price of everything goes up to match that? You see, you're only fooling yourself. I can remember when bread was a dime a loaf and when people worked for $1.50 a day. They don't work for that anymore, and they don't get bread for 10 cents a loaf anymore either. So one thing sort of checks the other out. Now, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. Why can a rich man not get any sleep? Or a video of the time, maybe. Well, let's say, you got an opinion on that? You don't have enough money to know this from experience, huh?
All right, Mr. Nutley.
He says that he's fine food and everything, he's big meals and doesn't digest.
All right, that's one reason. You go eat just rich and fattening food all the time. Why, and a good bit of alcohol with it, maybe this is likely to interfere with your sleep, Mr. Crawford.
Well, I don't think you
just
have the problem with the rich man just wouldn't get the
bodily
exercise, maybe the labor
would
work.
Well, this is
you
true, too.
Sit around and
All right. It's possibly too much, though, isn't it?
On
occasion. On occasion. Well, cross-country runners aren't afflicted this way, but it is possible to do it. You bring yours up, Mr. Crawford.
Once in a while, huh?
Now, in C.S. Lewis's book, Till We Have Faces, Orla Ralph, Queen of Gloam, after she's been through a good many things, she said she finally found out the great remedy for mental depression is sweat. S-W-E-A-T, sweat. She said, there's nothing like it. You get exercise till you really work up a sweat and are good and tired. This not only enables you to sleep that night, but it clears your brain of a lot of worries and complexes and one thing and another. She said, it's one of the greatest gifts of God to man is sweat. Another thing about it is it's cheap. Of course, it takes a little effort. It does. You know how much it costs to see a psychiatrist? Well, Ms. Carlson, do you know?
$50
an hour. Yeah, if you're willing to take one of the less distinguished ones. And it takes about 40 hours to talk in anything or out of anything. It's very expensive. Let me tell you, it's much cheaper to try prayer, kneel down by your bed, and get really honest with God. And I won't say that will cure all mental hang-ups, but it'll cure many of them. And it certainly doesn't cost $50 an hour to try that. And some of these people, if they try prayer, they wouldn't need so much psychiatry, maybe. Well, another thing, the rich man, of course, has many worries. You had $1 million, you'd have many problems about how to handle this money. And this would interfere with your sleep. Now, I can tell you, the sale of sleeping pills in America is terrific. Both the kind that are sold over the counter without a prescription, like Nitol and Somadex, these are not very effective. And any really effective sleeping pills, you have to have a doctor's prescription to get. And I suppose that's a good idea. Although some of them, a good many must be sold by bootleg too, perhaps. But the sale of these things is terrific. We are becoming a nation where people can't get to sleep without medication. They can't get wide awake in the morning without it either. This is certainly a bad sign. Now, I'll tell you, the real cure for insomnia is to go to church. The guy that can never get to sleep, you go to church, he'll get to sleep. He'll find out how it is possible to drop off and really relax, you know. I don't suppose this is as good as going to bed in your bed and really stretching out and relaxing, but going to church is almost a surefire cure for the fellow who says he can never get any sleep. Now, riches are harmful to men, 5:14, and evil travel. Luke Paul says this means some unfortunate enterprise. Suppose, now this doesn't bother people of our economic level, I'm sure, very much, but suppose you had piled up a fortune in trading in the stock market, and suddenly you get up in the morning to find the stock market has crashed, and the stock in XYZ Corporation that you bought for $14 a share, hoping to sell it for $24 a share, you find suddenly it's worth 10 cents a share, and it's gone. In Germany, at the end of World War I, inflation went absolutely wild. People would draw out their life savings and spend it on one dinner or one box of candy to take home. The money wasn't worth anything. In China, at the end of World War II, it got so badly inflated that it was worth more as paper than it was as money.
Actually, people papered their walls and they made fans and lampshades out of $1,000 bills. It was, and people who would get paid from a job would stop on the way home and spend that money on rice or potatoes or something, because if they kept it in the form of banknotes, it might be worth only half or less the next day. Like that. Absolutely terrific, the inflation. We got one, about that time, one airmail registered letter weighing an ounce and a half from Shanghai, just after the end of World War II. Business style envelope, one of these long ones. It would have cost, we figured, about $1.75 to send this by American Airmail and registered from here to Shanghai. This had on it the entire back, and one third of the front was covered with postage stamps of $100,000 each. On one letter, $100,000 each stamp. And the whole back of this envelope and a third of the front was covered with these. You see, money isn't worth anything anymore. Well, a person might have worked hard all their life and saved their money, and the profit suddenly is without value. And this kind of thing, you see, can hit a person pretty hard. Now, the person who never had all that money, when the stock market crashes, you don't own any stock. Stock market crashes, well, it's too bad and everything, but it doesn't hit you. And the person who works at a job and just gets his money day by day and week by week and isn't a rich man with a lot of fortune piled up, when one of these unfortunate crashes or fiascos comes, he doesn't lose everything either. And it is harder on a person to have it and lose it than it is to never have it. That makes sense? Think that would be true to life? Well, Tennyson. Anyone read Tennyson's poems? Boxley Hall. A sorrow's crown of sorrow is remembering better things. You can remember what you used to have, and this makes the present when you don't have it bitter and painful. A sorrow's crown of sorrow is remembering better things. It's starring Boxley Hall, his gal Jillian. He was left without it and couldn't get over it. Quite a piece of poetry. Comrades, leave me here a little while as yet 'tis early morn. Leave me here, and if you need me, sound upon the bugle horn. And, well, in view of all this, we are exhorted, chapter 5, 18 to 20, for a brief. Briefly here, to enjoy the gifts that God permits. Chapter 5, from verse 18 to verse 20. Since I've seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God, for he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answers him in the joy of his heart. Now, which do you remember? The happy times or the painful times in your past life? Well, you think a person ought to remember the happy times. But the fact is, they forget this. There's nothing really to mark it as outstanding. They enjoyed it and lived on through it. But if they were in a hospital and had a very serious operation and almost died, this they're likely to never forget. And so the tragic things, we tend to remember them. And the happy times that God has given us, we tend to take for granted and live through them. And when we're through, or when the time has passed, we tend, it says here, not to much remember. Chapter 5, verse 20. Not remember the days of his life, because God answers him in the joy of his heart. Now, the gift of God, mentioned in verse 19 here, every man whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, to take his portion, this is the gift of God.
Please note, the gift here is not riches or wealth or money or any of these things, but the ability to use them. You might have $1 million in the bank and enough money to buy all the food in 5 of the biggest supermarkets that there are, including the Wheels. But if you're doubled up with pain from appendicitis and waiting for the doctor to operate on you, why, all that food won't do you a bit of good. You can't eat it, you see. I heard of somebody had malaria and he was allergic to quinine, the cure of it. Can you imagine that kind of a situation? He has a disease and he's allergic to the only thing that's really effective in curing it. Somebody else got diabetes and they're allergic to insulin. Well, this is tragic, you see. This is really bad. And when it says, given him power to eat thereof, this means to enjoy all these things. It speaks of honor and so forth. You can't really eat honor. You ever try to eat a bowl full of it? You don't eat honor, but this is a Hebraism for enjoying it or getting the benefit or getting the good out of it. Now then, starting in chapter 6, the vanity of possessing goods that cannot be enjoyed. In view of the condition of Israel at the time when the book of Ecclesiastes was written, what kind of sinful thinking was likely to arise in their minds? Now, the people of Israel, were they rich or were they poor? Most of them. Poor. These Persian officials that had a monopoly on the rackets, how about them? Rich or poor? Rich. Now, if you're poor and living among people and everybody else is poor too, this doesn't bother you so much maybe, but if you're poor and lack things, and you see people around that have not only what they need, but 50 times more than what they need, and they're very inconsiderate in how they flaunt it around and show it off, this can easily arouse in you a gnawing spirit of envy and discontent. I don't say it's right, but it's very understandable that a person would feel that way. The people of Israel that were the chosen people of God, living in poverty and suffering injustice, and among them these rich big shots from the Persian Empire that had everything and didn't give a hoot what happened to Israel. This could easily lead to covetous, envious thoughts and a spirit of discontent. Now, let me ask you as a Christian, is discontent sinful? Ms. Ventrell, is it? 2 years ago at the opening of college, our present dean of students, Reverend Lord McMillan, spoke and he spoke on the subject of apathy. The student newspaper was constantly hitting on this, that our students were filled with apathy. Apathy. They're too easily satisfied with things as they are. This is apathy. A-P-A-T-H-Y. And Mr. McMillan said, a lot of this isn't really apathy at all. It's Christian contentment. A Christian person, even a Christian college student, has the greater and higher values that bring true joy and peace and contentment to life. He isn't going to get uptight about every little thing that somebody could raise a point about. If you can't smoke cigarettes except on the other side of the lower road, well, you don't have to make an issue of this. This is just the way it is. And he said a lot of so-called apathy is just contentment. And I wonder if this isn't true, that part of the harping on apathy among students isn't stirred up by students who do not know Jesus Christ and are not saved. This could be. I'm not saying that there are no things that ought to be changed and corrected. Even Christian students can have a genuine case for something that ought to be improved or altered. But to this constant, sort of a rumbling of discontent. We had a missionary from New Guinea spoke here. Maybe some of you remember hearing this man. He'd been among cannibals. Remember that guy? He said, to this chief, you're pulling my leg. And this chief said, not yet. Just wait. But he started out his speech. He had a very unusual sense of humor. He said, what'd you come to college for? Gripe, gripe, gripe.
And he went on to say, there are millions of young people who would be glad to come to college, and that gripe, gripe, gripe. But you're in college and got the benefits, and what do you do? Gripe, gripe, gripe. I don't know who told him to say that. It certainly was not. But this is true of some people. Now, being in poverty might lead to covetous thoughts. The Apostle Paul, while in prison in Rome, said, I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. This is a jewel of Christian character that God can enable us to cultivate. And the more you are surrounded by people that have more than you have, when I see a student has a better tape recorder than I can afford to buy, I'm envious of him. Not to mention one that drives a better car than I can afford to buy, belonging, of course, to his father. But just all right, this stirs up feelings of envy. Now, this may refer to the Persians. A lot of different kinds of wealth are mentioned in chapter 6, verse 2 here. This may possibly mean these rich Persians that were here and there over the country, or perhaps, more probably, any rich man whose experiences fit this description. Chapter 6, verse 2, a man whom God hath given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all that he desireth, yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof. But a stranger eateth it. This is vanity. It is an evil disease. To eat thereof is the figure of speech I was saying. This means to enjoy it. You can't really eat on it. Now, chapter 6, verse 3 speaks of the ultimate disgrace among the Jewish people. If a man beget 100 children, would you call that a pretty fair example of a family-sized population exploding? 100 children, and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial. I say that an untimely birth is better than he. Among the people of Israel, to be without a burial after your death was the absolute, absolute, ultimate shame and disgrace. The human body was to be treated as sacred, and your worst enemy, after you've gotten through killing him, is entitled to be treated with honor and respect and have a proper burial. And this was the ultimate. Here, Jehoiakim, king of Judah, that had got his nerve up and tore up and burned the book of the prophecies of Jeremiah. Jeremiah predicted of him he would have no burial. No record of this being fulfilled. There's no record of it not being fulfilled either. He was captured and disappeared from the scene. But no burial. This was called in the Old Testament the burial of the man. Who wants to dig a hole to put a dead donkey in? There's no money in it. It cost him over the cliff back of McKee Hall. As somebody did two cats one time. They were used up ones. A burial of an ass. But this was considered the ultimate disgrace. Here in the history of King Saul, he finally, well, he was wounded and then committed suicide in a battle with the Philistines, and the Philistines took his body and those of his sons, cut their heads off, and put the bodies up on the wall of the city of Bethshan. A terrible disgrace from a Jewish point of view, and the men of Jabesh Gilead, a town in the Jordan Valley where Saul had once saved them from having their right eyes put out. The men of Jabesh Gilead, although Saul had died a poor wreck of a man, a failure, and even a suicide, they never forgot what Saul had done for them. They marched through the night at the risk of their own life and took the bodies of Saul and his sons off of the wall of Bethshan and buried them decently. And this is true of all the scripture, Mr. Fenton.
Then in the
chapel, this was a man that came to Jesus and said, I'll follow you wherever you go, but first let me go and bury my father. Now this surely doesn't mean, in view of the whole attitude of the Jews toward the dead, His father had died that morning and he had to go home for the funeral. This means go home and wait till my father dies. It may be 14 years yet. And in view of this, Jesus said, suffer the dead to bury their dead. That is, this was not a spiritually live option. His father is presumably not a believer, and this might take years out of this man's life. You go and preach the kingdom of God. I think that's what that means. Now, just another example or two. There's a queen named Jezebel. What happened to her? Well, she got processed outside of her royal palace. She was tossed out of the window by order of that Buffalo Bill Jehu. And when they went to collect the remains for a royal funeral, all they could find was part of her skull, part of the soles of her feet, and part of the palms of her hands. There was no funeral for Jezebel. The dogs had eaten the rest. I marvel at some of these companies that produce dog food don't put out the Jezebel brand. At the present day, it might just be a popular sale item. But this was also considered the ultimate shame and disgrace that is mentioned here. Now, 442, what Old Testament texts outside of Ecclesiastes regard long life as a blessing of God? See, this speaks of a man who has a long life here. It says he lived many years, and the days of his life were many. Now, you could mention different ones. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Psalm 91:16, with long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. On the other hand, life in the Old Testament and New Testament also is a qualitative and not merely a quantitative idea. In God's favor is life. Life is, in the true sense, is a qualitative concept, not simply extension of this present life X years off into the future, but enjoyment of the full favor and blessing of God, with no moral barrier to cut God off from you or you from God. This is life. Jesus said, this is eternal life, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom thou hast sent. Now, Koheleth says, if a man lived 2,000 years, 6:6. If he live 1,000 years twice told, yet hath seen no good, do not all go to one place. He lived 2,000 years. Well, nobody lives this old. Even Methuselah didn't live anywhere near, of course, this. But if a person could, still, if he gets no satisfaction in life and has no burial after his death, then let's say his life is vain, it is empty, it is unsatisfying. Now, in what respect is it true that all go to one place, as stated in chapter 6, verse 6? This is true only if you are considering things under the sun. As I have said before in this class, if a person isn't a Christian, death is, well, even for a Christian, their funeral is the end of their life in this world. Death brings the curtain down on your career in this world. Jesus said, we must work the works of him that sent me, while this day, the night cometh when no man can work. If you're a Christian, you know that there is eternal life beyond death, and this is your real life, but as far as this world is concerned, see, under the sun, death is the end. And this is true of the good and of the bad, of the believer and of the unbeliever, in this respect, but in this respect only. And we must take other places in the book of Ecclesiastes, such as where it says the Spirit shall return to God who gave it in the last chapter, along with this. It is true in the sense that, let's say, life after death is not a place for making up lost opportunities in this world. If you flunk Bible 302, don't think you can take it again in heaven and get credit for the course. This is limited to an option in this world. And let's say eternal life, which a believer has, is not, let's say, an opportunity to make up for lost opportunities in this world. It's something different in its own right, and the supreme value, of course. But lost opportunities are lost. and you don't get them back. Now, 6:7, all as a man toil is for his mouth, yet his mouth is not satisfied, his appetite is not appeased. Man is insatiable. He always wants more. I heard somebody say, if I had $1 million, I'd be satisfied. I wonder, would you, Mr. Master, if you had $1 million, would you be satisfied? All right. The people that have $1 million, are they satisfied?
They try
to get more, don't they?
Yeah.
Now, John D. Rockefeller, the first that founded the original Standard Oil Company, he went around with a pocket full of shiny diamonds and gave them to people. On the other hand, he made his dollars out of people. But he wasn't satisfied to stop at any point. And these rich men are not. And the love of money is the sort of the self-perpetuating moral disease which produces more hunger for the same. And there isn't any stopping place short of the end of your life in this world. There's a line I'll quote you from the Latin poet Virgil. I'm sure you're all Latin students. Auri sapa fame, quid non mortalia cogit pectora. Anybody understand it? Cursed hunger for gold. To what dost thou not drive the hearts of mortal men? Cursed hunger for gold. To what dost thou not drive the hearts of mortal men? It's been true since Virgil's time before Christ, and it's still true today. Always wanting more, and Leupold says this is a sickness, this is a spiritual disease. Such a soul has been stricken and damaged by sin. Now, 6:8, we read about the wise man and the fool, chapter 6, verse 8. Time is running out on us a little here, but let's see. For what hath the wise man more than the fool? What hath the poor that knoweth to walk before the living? Now, I think it is necessary to state at this point that in the Old Testament, the poor does not ordinarily mean the economically poor. This is shown by what it is contrasted with. The poor is not usually contrasted with the rich, but with the proud or with the wicked. You check it out. This would be a Sunday afternoon Bible study for you someday. So check this out through the book of Psalms, for example, and see how this term, the poor, is used. Something like what Jesus did when he said, blessed are the poor in spirit. And this means the afflicted and mistreated and persecuted and underprivileged people of God who love God and God loves and so forth, over against the haughty and the proud of this world, who may also be rich, but that is not the point of the comparison. It's the poor versus the proud, or the poor versus the wicked, in most places, not perhaps in every place. Now, in this verse here, we read about the wise man and about the fool, and the poor who knows how to walk before the living. The wise man here must be a member of Israel. The fool must be a member of the ruling nation, the Persians, or other heathen powers. And that knoweth to walk before the living knows really how to steer and aim a life according to wisdom. Nobody in the ancient world but Israel really knew how to do this. Paul says the heathen were groping around in the darkness after God, as happy they might find him. Paul at Mars Hill, at Athens. Groping in the darkness after God. And Israel had light. They had the real revelation of God that told them how to live a life that has an aim. They go someplace that is steered straight. They had a map and a compass to go by. And so Israel were the only people who knew how to walk before the living on the face of the earth. God gave them his written word, statutes and ordinances that showed them how to walk according to a rule that was pleasing to God and therefore also acceptable to man and so forth, under ordinary conditions at least. This is the people of Israel. Now, they too can be involved in this cursed hunger for gold, this sick mind that wants more and more and more, and so he has to guard against that here. 6:9, the wandering of the desire. What is the wandering of the desire? Well, do you ever daydream about what you'd like to have and haven't got? Anybody ever do this in Christian college? Mr. Morasco, do you think they do? All right. Like to engage to the prettiest girl in the freshman class, you know, and so forth. But unfortunately, she's already married or something. wandering around, not enjoying what God has given you, but on the contrary, wishing you had something different. I read of a family where the kids disputed about who got the biggest piece of cake, and the mother saw it. She said, "Mary can cut the cake, and Billy can choose first." To solve that problem, one of them cuts the cake, the other one chooses which piece they want. And under these circumstances, the cake cutter is going to do it conscientiously and properly. Now the contrast here is between them. Let's say, hold it just a minute, the wandering of the desire and enjoying what God has given you. I had a poem I was going to read. I'll save it and read it next time. But how about America today? Are we a nation that is always wanting more of everything and never satisfied? The highest standard of living in the world, let me tell you, common folks like college professors today live better than kings and queens did 50 years ago. 50 years ago, kings and queens didn't have an electric refrigerator in their house or a car that you could start by just turning the key. But even college students have these things today. And yet, in spite of the highest standard of living the world has ever known, we are probably the most discontented people that ever lived. And more about that next time.